Previously on Electric Boogaloo.
I mean, he's always been a little bit saucy, but I would say that this is his sauciest episode.
This is, yes, as saucy as he gets.
Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2, Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week's conversation is with Dr. Robert Rouse. He has taught several classes on Game of Thrones at University of British Columbia. We'll be covering Arya's first POV chapter, that's chapter 7. I'll also include my conversations with Lisa Woolfork and Gregory Webster, both related to Arya. So it's an Arya-heavy podcast this week. She's my favorite. We'll also check in with Steve, who's done his very first viewing of You Win or You Die, Episode 7. First up is the short excerpt from Lisa Woolfork, and then we'll cover Chapter 7 with Professor Rouse.
The reason why you were on my radar in the first place, Dr. Woolfork, is that I saw that you taught a class at UVA.
Yes.
Related to Game of Thrones, and I thought we could swap class stories. So I used this book once for an ethics class, and
I loved it.
But I want to hear about your class and how it was framed and really how the students received it.
It was a wonderful class. I taught it for about 5 years, and what we concentrated on was, because it was in a truncated semester, I did this in the summer session, which is just 4 weeks.
Mm.
So in the first week of the class, we read the first novel. That was the first 5 days. And there was a quiz every day, and there was a great, rich conversation of the first novel. And then I paired the novel with secondary scholarly sources. We looked at about 30 episodes of the HBO series.
Okay.
It was pretty great because a lot of students that they were very dedicated, whether they had seen the show before or not seen it before. And so we were all pretty much watching season 7 as it was happening. We spent a lot of time talking about that, and which was some really great and rich conversations. But I'm not a big fan of just lecturing. I much prefer to have discussion centered, student-driven learning. You know what I mean? I really like that. I mean, I think that I'm fascinating and amazing and really smart, but I don't want to talk for 2.5 hours straight about anything.
Yes, both things can be true. You can be fascinating and you can talk for too long. The class that I taught, for a lot of years, I slept around as an adjunct professor. And one of the classes I was able to latch on to was this ethics class, and I'd never taught ethics before. Because my background is in religious studies. And
the one of my good friends, I have so many good friends in religious studies, and they also do ethics, but then they don't think that they're ethicists.
That's right.
So it's funny because I have this misperception, and my friends who are in religious studies say it's a misperception. Mm-hmm. I think that religious studies professors are like holy people. And they're like, no, we are not
opposite. The reason why we became professors is that we do not think that we're holy people, right?
Oh, goodness. So that's funny. So you have a religious studies background, which you thought made you an ethicist material. I guess because ethicist is usually part of philosophy. Is that right?
So I felt somewhat ill-equipped to pick up this class at the last minute. They offered me this class at the last minute.
Mm-hmm.
And it required me to drive 2 hours to the classroom.
Oh,
you know, it's like a 2-hour class, and I'm driving 4 hours to do this class. The life of an adjunct professor, right?
Yeah.
So the idea for the class was at the University of Pacific was that the students will choose a book, and then what they'll do is they'll interact with the book and write their own ethical framework paper based on this book. And I thought, you know, there were like 40 students in the class, and I thought, you know what? I've never taught this class before. There's no way I am going to read 40 books because they're each going to choose a different book.
Right.
So, So as much as I love to read, I'm not going to do that. So I thought, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to choose 3 books that are important to me, and I'll make them 3 books of a much different type. And none of these books are going to represent my religious upbringing at all. So whatever lecturing that I bring to the class, at least that there's a little bit of diversity in these books. And so the three books that I chose were A.J. Jacobs' Year of Living Biblically, which is really sort of
I know that book.
He's a humorist. It's basically a journal. The book is a journal of him trying to live out the Bible literally as...
Yeah, not shaving and no shellfish.
Yes, exactly. So that was one option. Another option was the autobiography of Malcolm X, Alex Haley. And then, of course, I chose A Game of Thrones.
And oh my gosh, that is so funny. So how do the three of those work together? My goodness.
They don't. And I think that the students, like, I didn't really know what I was doing, but I knew that those were important books for me. And so I would be able to interact with them. And so the students got to choose one of these books. And of course, you know, a lot of the students chose A Game of Thrones because there was a series out. And so that's how I used that book. I never taught the class again. And I only did that because I was asked to do it at the last minute. I thought, hey, I got to choose three books that I love. Right. And so that's why I did it. I want to ask you a question, and I don't think you're prepared for it. So if you want to avoid the question, you can.
Okay.
Of all of the characters in all of these books, who is the character that your friends and family think you are? But then the second question is, deep down inside, the character that you know, you really have affinity with this one character.
That is interesting. That is really a great question. I like it. And you know, I am not super prepared for it because the question has to do with how do people, it's kind of one of those memes that say what my friends think I do and what I really do.
Exactly. That's it.
It's really perfect. And I only have like 167 named characters to choose from.
That's right.
So I don't know. I really feel an affinity. I feel like my friends and family might think of me as Sam.
Okay. Tell me more about that.
And I think of that just because this is someone who's been able to change his life through books. And through literacy and through reading and through research. I think that Sam is like the patron saint of college professors everywhere. Right?
Yeah, he's able like, to. Yeah, books are like a salvation for Sam, right?
They really are similar. And I think they're a salvation for him in a way that they are not for Tyrion Lannister, who is often seen as like, you know, a very bookish, you know, who's often known for his literacy. But I think that Tyrion's wealth and social position make this a lot more optional for him. For Sam, throughout the series, books save him. They save him from a cruel father until they stop saving him when he comes of age. They give him a position as the new maester, you know, later on, you know, to serve the Night's Watch in a way that's permanent and important. And he's a repository for a lot of knowledge, particularly in a culture where stories and oral histories are critical.
Yes.
And so he knows a lot of these stories and legends. He's the one that's able to distinguish between a dead body that's fresh versus one that's old. And the books say this. I read it in a book.
Yeah. But I love this, actually. He's sort of just escaped from Craster's Keep, and he's escaped from another. He's just killed another.
That's right.
And he's with Gilly, who is like most of the people in that culture, they're illiterate.
That's right.
And he's able to find this gateway through the wall only because he read it in a book. And Gilly looks at him.
And it's like, are you a wizard?
Yes. You must be, for her, writing is like magic.
Yes, it is.
And he, you know, in the show, we learn that he always wanted to be a wizard. And in that moment, he gets to become a wizard in her eyes. I love that part of it.
Yes, that's right. And this is, you know, someone who was mocked for basically being like a nerd, right? And yet...
Well, in a culture where being a nerd means that your father might kill you.
Well, I know. I mean, it's just, yeah. Overall, it seems like a pretty crappy place to live. I'll tell you that much.
So you have affinity for Sam.
But what I would actually prefer, the people who I would like, if I wanted to see the people that I admire the most in the series, the people that I absolutely admire the most are Daenerys and Arya.
Okay.
Both of them I admire as characters. I think I really liked what Martin did with them. I have no idea how they turn out in the final books because we don't have those yet. So I'm just looking at the series for guidance. And I think that Daenerys is completely done dirty in season 7, but that's not a question for today. And Arya just turns out to be 100% that bitch. Excuse my language. I mean,
no,
she,
I love it. You know what? I am such an Arya guy. I love Arya. She's my favorite. So tell me why she's your favorite.
She's my favorite because this is someone who's been able to navigate this system. Mm. All of these systems are arrayed against her.
Yeah.
You know, unlike Bran, she's not going to run a house of her own. She's not going to be a banner man. She wants to be. She would much rather be a banner man to her brother than a lady of anybody's house.
Right.
And she goes through these cultures in a way that I think reverses these narratives of colonial dominance.
Mm.
She's not going there as someone who wants with a position of mastery or dominance, or I'm from Westeros and the rest of you all in Essos.
No, she's a student. She's going there as a student.
She is curious. She is curious. She admits she doesn't know things. She wants to learn. She practices, she studies, she accepts correction, she grows, like all of these things. And then she is also able to use her physical body in ways that women, with the exception of Brienne of Tarth, are able to do. You know, like this is a very grim world for women, and it's a world where women are subject to sexual violence all the time.
Mm.
And for me to have a woman who's able to navigate around that, not only it reinforces the permanence of rape culture within the series period, but it also shows that that's not a totality. And I think that gives me something to root for, even if it's rare.
Right. You know, Martin does that. I mean, he really walks that knife's edge, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Because in order to...
What do you mean? Between what and what?
I was just thinking about the question of rape culture. This is a much bigger question, but there's a sense in which Martin wants to... If he wants to say something about feminism, he's going to have to do it... First off, he's going to have to do it as this white dude writing in the early 90s, right?
That's right.
He doesn't have the option to be someone else. But he almost has to paint this portrait of how bleak it is in order to have someone like Brienne or Arya shine in the midst of that darkness.
That's right. And you have to be able to illustrate that. I think that Brienne and Arya's resistance to this culture shows how corrupt the culture is, and that there are women who are able to find their way through it without destroying themselves or without completely capitulating to a system that requires in some way their compliance. It requires everybody's compliance, but it requires more, I believe, of the female characters. And this is why I think that Brienne and Arya are such fan favorite, in the same ways that someone like Sansa, and at least as far as in my reading, has gotten a lot of fan contempt until the very, very end. Or that even Cersei, it has this kind of grudging admiration because she's learned to play the game, even though she continues to be underestimated by lots of people. In the series. And the only reason they underestimate her is because she's a woman. And she knows that. So.
Well, and Arya's really remarkable. I mean, the way that they set up Sansa in the first place is through Arya's eyes.
Yes.
And Arya, her perception of her older sister is, it's not just about contempt. It's about that person represents everything that I'm not good at.
Yes.
And she's so advanced.
Envy and rivalry.
That's right. This person, Sansa, is advancing in all of the ways that are expected of her. And I cannot, even though I'm a better, you know, I'm a better writer, that doesn't help me in the way that it helps Sansa, that she's socially graceful.
That's right.
And I think that sort of prepares the reader to root for Arya over and against Sansa. But also, Arya is so courageous at such a young age.
Yes.
And we almost forget that Sansa's 13 years old, you know?
That's right. Everybody is so young that Bran is 7.
Mm.
You know,
and that's right. What
is, and Rob is 14, and I think that John is also 14 or 13, or maybe they're 15 and 14. Yes. They're all young.
Yes. And I feel like Sansa, like my impression of Sansa was negative very early on, probably because of those. I loved Arya so much. And it was because in this first book, every opportunity that Sansa has where she could either choose the courageous option or the option of self-interest, I feel like she's always choosing the option of self-interest.
Hmm.
And here I am forgetting that I'm looking at this older sibling through the eyes of a much younger sibling.
Exactly.
And, you know, and so, and then of course, Sansa becomes this fantastically interesting character in the later books.
And it's interesting that you use the phrase self-interest versus self-preservation.
That's right. That's exactly right.
And so like, you know, who doesn't want to, you know, who doesn't act in their self-interest? Everybody, we all make decisions every single day.
Exactly.
In our self-interest.
And especially when you're 13 years old and you're in a society that has taught you to act in certain ways, right?
Exactly. And it's also worth thinking about, why is it that when Bran looks at his older brothers, that's at Rob and at John, mm-hmm. he looks at them through admiration and through just kind of interest. Whereas when Arya looks at Sansa, it's through rivalry.
Yes.
I mean, there is nothing that Sansa has that Arya can have. Neither,
that's right.
Neither one of them are going to get anything, right? They're both going to get sold off to some man that's going to make the Stark alliances stronger throughout the realm. Like,
yes.
That is what they are for. They are meant to advance the family strength, right? That is what they are meant to do. And so it makes no sense in my mind for Arya and Sansa to be in conflict, or for Arya to be kind of jealous of Sansa when they're not even fighting over scraps. Right?
Right.
They're fighting over absolutely, like, nothing.
And now Chapter 7 with Robert Rouse.
Dr. Robert Rouse. Now, is that how I pronounce your name? I'm not certain about that.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay. All right. I want to ask, what is your relationship to your own voice?
Good question. It's a really revealing question. My relationship to my own voice is a problematic one. Like, I don't know about you, but whenever you hear yourself being recorded back,
right,
it's very hard to recognize yourself.
That's
like when
right.
you play this and you're like, who is that? Who the hell is that idiot? But like for me, it's even more so. Like I grew up in New Zealand, so I had an accent that is very typical of a New Zealander, although my parents were British, so that meant it was a little bit off in the first place.
Uh-huh.
Then I lived in the UK for a long time. And then now I've lived in Canada for 15 years. So I don't really place myself when I hear my accent anymore.
Yeah, you're a little hybrid, I think.
Yeah, very much. Like I remember the first trip I did back to New Zealand in 2001. I left in 99 for grad uh-huh. school. And I went back and I read a physio. And the physio was like, oh, so which part of the UK are you from? And this was an Australian physio in New Zealand asking me what part of the UK. I was like, I was born here, you F. but you know, the voice just adapts to where you are. And
yeah, you're sort of at the mercy of your context, right?
Yeah, very much. Like I'm from all sorts of places. My wife is from Toronto, but lived in Europe for a long time.
Sure.
So both of us find everybody sounds weird.
All right. So I'd like to do a quick synopsis of the chapter that we're covering. We're looking at Arya's first point of view chapter, which is chapter 7.
Yes.
So we meet Arya and Sansa and Jane Poole, Septon Mordain, Beth Castle, and Myrcella Lannister. And they are practicing the quote unquote womanly arts, but Arya's no good at them. And so her stitches are crooked. She's not quite connecting with the other girls in the room. In fact, they're talking about how handsome Joffrey is, or, you know, maybe he's not so handsome in Arya's point of view. Then she gets chided by Septa Mordane. Her stitches aren't quite perfect. And she leaves. She bolts. She leaves the room, and she finds Jon Snow and Ghost overlooking the yard where people are sparring. She wants to be with the boys. The boys are playing at swords, and she's much more comfortable over there. She has a very interesting exchange with Jon about the roles of girls and bastards. Then she goes back to her room to find her mother and Septa Mordane waiting for her ominously. And that's the chapter in a nutshell. And you wouldn't think that there was a lot going on in it besides a few notable conversations. But there's a lot of interesting details about these characters that I find fascinating. And I'll admit right now, Arya is my favorite character. And so I'm always going to find the Arya chapters fascinating. But I'm curious, Robert, you're an expert on medieval literature. What in this chapter jumps out to you? I'm curious to hear how you're reading it.
Yeah, so two different sort of approaches here. First is the approach of the literary scholar that's looking for themes, that's looking for words. And, you know, as you pointed out, the immediate word that comes into play is needlepoint.
Yes.
You know, this is a scene about needlepoint and about needlepoint that will become, as it were. And yes. What I mean by that is you have two juxtaposed scenes. You have the scene of the women, and then you have the scene of the men. And this is doing a number of things in terms of both a construction of that concept of needlepoint as work and different kinds of work. But it's also, as a medievalist, it immediately draws you to the concept of gendered work, which is very present in the Middle Ages, but of course is still present today in lots of different ways. Mm-hmm. There are kinds of work that are associated with men and women in different societies at different points in time. And here we have a really clear distinction being made between the needlepoint, the private gendered work of the women in their little enclosed indoor area where they're all working away on the socially acceptable art, mm-hmm. or perhaps work, versus the public arena where the men are preparing for their kind mm-hmm. of work, which mm-hmm. is warfare and killing. So the movement between those two places is really important. And the two characters that perform that movement are also very, very telling. We have Arya, who is kind of has a bodily destiny not to be in the woman's world, but to be in the world. You know, even at the start where it talks about the fact that she has the hands of a blacksmith. She's already kind right. of has a bodily destiny to be part of that other world.
Sure.
And then the figure of Jon, who again is perfectly poised as an observer because he's overlooking, he's not part of, he can't be part of, as he points out,
yeah.
this performance of public masculinity.
Right.
He has to watch from the shadows, literally.
That's right.
So I think you got two things going on here. One, you've got like the comparison and the contrast between women's work, which is private, which is inside, which is interior.
Yeah, very much an insider outsider.
Yeah,
thing,
and then
right?
the public world of men and reputation. But mm-hmm. at the same time, that's sort of shown to us through these two different spaces. And one of the other things I do is I work on spatial theory a lot. And the fact that you have this small enclosed space, which is women, this big public space, it connects with you know, the way in which social history has been written over the last mm-hmm. 50 years, the way in which we've gone from these big public narratives to thinking about how social history works within domestic spaces.
Yeah.
It's as you say, it's a very short chapter. It's a very compact chapter for putting into play certain very key ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, then we get the echo of needlepoint. We have at one point here John saying you couldn't even lift a long sword. And so of course, what does he do? He has a needle produced to her.
That's
her
right.
Later in the book.
Yeah.
And so needlepoint becomes a kind of ongoing redefined concept of women's work.
I want to read a little passage here that I think plays into this theme. So this is John and Arya discussing the coat of arms on Joffrey. All right. So look at the arms on his surcoat, John suggested. Arya looked. An ornate shield had been embroidered on the prince's padded surcoat. No doubt the needlework was exquisite. The arms were divided down the middle. On one side was the crowned stag of the royal house. On the other, the line of Lannister. The Lannisters are proud, John observed. You'd think that the royal sigil would be sufficient, but no. He makes his mother's house equal in honor to the king's. The woman is important too, Arya protested. John chuckled, perhaps you should do the same thing, little sister. Wed the Tully to the Stark in your arms. A wolf with a fish in its mouth? She laughed. That would look silly. Besides, if a girl can't fight, why should she have a coat of arms? John shrugged. Girls get the arms, but not the swords. Bastards get the swords, but not the arms. I did not make the rules, little sister. And I like that little bit for a number of reasons. Number one, it ties in the embroidery theme that we are introduced to at the very beginning. Like, he notices that Joffrey's wearing a split coat of arms. And of course, this sort of recalls for Arya the needlework that she's supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. It drops a little hint about Joffrey's true parentage, right? Maybe he's more Lannister than he is Baratheon. I like this for a number of reasons. We also have this sort of display of affection between the two. These two have more in common than they have difference. It seems to me.
It's a lovely little piece that the dense piece that you've brought up. One thing I'd add to that is, so needlepoint and embroidery, the joining of houses is also part of women's work, right? Because women bring children to the world. And so another part of their domestic role is producing these hybrid creatures, these hybrid bodies. And you also have, like, in Arya's point that the women are important too, it also raises that huge question of Martin and feminism, you know, which has been debated.
Yes.
My students write about it all the time from different points of view. And you can say through figures like Arya, and maybe through a figure like Sansa that changes and becomes so strong later on in the narratives, that Martin does kind of have a feminist approach to his work, but at the same time, he really, really doesn't. So it's raising this idea, and then John bats it down again. And John's really interesting because, you know, John dismisses it with, I don't make the rules.
Mm-hmm.
But John kind of does make the rules at the same time, or at least he articulates the rules. Because all the way through the book, one of the things that John does is John is the voice of kind of reality. He's a bit like, you know, the good-natured version of Sandor Clegane in terms of those kind of like truthful statements about
reality. Yeah, he can kind of cut through the pageantry and sort of be a truth teller, right?
Yeah, he can. Like at the end of this chapter, the chapter ends with John saying nothing is fair.
Sure.
His phrases kind of like echo through the book, but they're not always right.
Well, okay, but here we have John. Arya doesn't know it, but John knows at this point in the story that he is going to the wall.
Yes.
And he's going to the wall primarily because he's motivated by his social placement. The wall is the only place where he's going to be able to advance and no longer be a bastard.
Yeah.
Or so he thinks, right? And so there are very few avenues for advancement for him because of his social role. And I think that he's quietly reflecting on that when he says nothing is fair.
You're right.
Even so, I mean, it's different for Arya than it is for John, but there are some similarities there too. So I guess the question is, John does make the rules. In other words, here's what I would say. I would say John reinforces the rules.
Yeah, that's what he articulates. Yeah.
And he almost reinforces the rules by taking this beta role in all of these relationships. He's always going to remind everyone in the room that he's not a true Stark.
Yeah.
And by doing that, he's always going to remind people of the social hierarchy.
Yeah. And curiously, like, as you say, he does kind of buy into his own subjection in that way.
Yes.
Because we see other bastards in the novels really not playing by these rules. Right? You just have to go up and go a little further north to the Boltons, right? Yeah. So it's obviously possible within the society that we're reading about for bastards to occupy important positions. Maybe not to inherit, but
accept.
When they do, but to still be really valuable members of their family, even if they're on the outside of that. John, in his typical Starkness, just plays it straight and says, I cannot, therefore I must leave.
Mm-hmm.
So as you say, he does kind of like reinforce the rules in that way.
Well, and bastards are a threat, even if only 1-5% of these bastards actually inherit. They represent a threat to the family in a number of ways, because what, you know, what if they do jump their station? What would this mean for the rest of us?
Yes, the instability.
They bring about of instability and insecurity to an otherwise stable system.
Yeah, and that's very much how they operated in medieval culture as well. Like, yeah, there were legal processes by which bastards could become legitimized in the medieval period in different parts of Europe at different times. It differed. And so they were always kind of, as you say, hanging around on the margins, representing a possible alternative, if a problematic one. You know, half a bloodline is better than no bloodline if you're thinking about potential rulers, potential leaders. So they were dealt with in the real Middle Ages in interesting ways, often by being given quite privileged positions to keep them happy, so that they would be happy with what they were given, but not try and overreach that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So then Arya's responsibility, of course, is to eventually do for the Stark family what Sansa's prepared to do, so she can become half of that embroidered coat of arms, right? Mm. That's sort of Arya's destiny in a way, one that she's not prepared for yet. And really, she doesn't have to confront it yet, but she knows that she's not happy with gendered expectations of herself.
Yeah, yeah, very much. Hence her continual fleeing.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. We never see Arya in the position of having to be Sansa. She's, you know, she's younger, she's not ready for that, and things fall apart dramatically before she is. But I think the threat and the fear is always there. And what I mean by that is the very real threat to women who were not, let's just say, suited to that kind of future. And if you're an aristocratic woman in the real Middle Ages or in Game of Thrones, that is your destiny. You know, as her mother has talked about, her mother who goes north and talks so much about this great sacrifice that she makes for her family. And as a number of the other ones, you know, Cersei talks about the sacrifices she makes for the family in terms of political marriages. That was a reality for all aristocratic women in the Middle
Ages. I wanted to ask you a question about geography.
Yeah.
Because a lot of these medieval maps will include beyond borders or beyond exploration. They'll include places like paradise.
Yeah.
Or they'll include places, you know, like, here be dragons or whatever.
Yeah. Literally off the map. Yeah.
Literally off the map. So there's a sense, even in the medieval period, that if you traveled far enough, you might find a supernatural place. You could go beyond the end of the world and meet these fantastic creatures, heaven and hell sort of creatures. And Martin does that a little bit with the Wall, doesn't he?
He does. Yeah. So there are kind of boundaries that man should not really go past, or the edge of the civilization. But the medieval period is interesting for that, because you actually run into them in a lot of travel accounts. For example, you know, the medieval encyclopedias talked about the fact if you go, you know, beyond the Caspian Sea, you'll start running into the world of monsters. And if you look at a medieval map, often along the margins and edges, you have the monstrous races, which are a classical idea which is sort of transmitted down through the medieval period. But when you actually start to read the one of the really interesting places where this gets tested or explored is in the narratives of the early travelers to China. So there's a couple of early travelers in the 13th and 14th century. One is called William of Rubruck, and he's a monk who is sent by the Pope to the court of the Great Khans after the Mongols make contact with Western Europe in the 13th century. And so he travels all the way there, and his account is very interesting of like all the pragmatic difficulties of traveling thousands of miles through Central Asia, which is problematic for a start. But more interesting, like to someone who's interested in the history of race and cartography, is the interactions between his book knowledge and what he actually encounters. So, for example, when he gets beyond the Caspian Sea, his sources, his sort of learned sources, are telling him that he should start to encounter monopods and these other kind of monstrous races. Mm. But he doesn't. It's just more people. And he gets there, so he's like, they must have meant beyond the next hill. Beyond the next lake. Oh, beyond there. And so he keeps pushing the boundaries back as he travels through. And that's kind of fascinating for a start, is that the world expands, but the monsters stay there on the edges. They always have to be there. There's another narrative called The Book of John Mandeville, which is a collection of travel narratives that have worked into one fictitious travel narrative. And that's really interesting because that includes one story as a counter narrative to The Monstrous Races of a man. Mandeville's telling of the wonders of the world. And he says one of the most wondrous stories he ever heard was of a man who walked east and walked for many years and eventually found a miraculous, strange world where they spoke the same language that he spoke. So basically he circled the world and ended up in a village 2 miles to the west of where he started. And so they were aware that the world was round. They were aware that the world was not this kind of like bounded place, but yeah. At the same time their stories told them they were. And so for a lot of medieval writers and thinkers, it was taking these two ideas and making those two ideas work together. It's kind of fascinating. And I don't know how much.
Well, that's right. And you keep going, you keep finding humans. But you also, if you go far enough, you'll find something like an elephant.
Yes.
Right? And the elephant is as fantastic a monster as you could ever imagine in the first place. Yeah. And so there is sort of this, not just a confounding of expectations, but there's also like, oh my gosh, this is even more amazing than I had ever imagined it could be.
Yeah.
And so the world of monsters changes.
It does. It becomes the world of fascination.
It becomes, like, yeah, that's right.
The exotic. That's in right. Lots of different ways. Like, and again, the medieval period was very good at that. One of the narratives I teach quite often is a narrative called The Siege of Jerusalem, which is this, which is a retelling of Titus's destruction of Jerusalem in around about 50 AD. And in that one, it's very interesting because you have the Roman Empire destroying the Jewish city of Jerusalem in this kind of weird retroactive revenge for the death of Christ.
Huh.
They're not actually Christian yet, but they can do it anyway because they're going to become Christians. It's a very weird story. It's sure. Part of the vengeance of the Lord narratives. But in that one, because it's written in the 13th and 14th century, the versions I teach, anyone in the Middle Ages must have Middle East must have elephants, like the Saracen armies, the Arab right. armies do.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You have the Romans attacking Jerusalem in around 50 AD, but the Jewish army looks exactly like a 14th century Arabic army.
Interesting.
With elephants and castles on elephants and all that kind of stuff. So you're right, the exotic becomes the thing that's kind of irrespective of time, but very much located to place.
That's so interesting. It's very, very Tarantino in this this way. Yeah,
very much.
So let me ask a couple questions about this chapter specifically. We've got some notable introductions in this chapter. Mm-hmm. We learned that Arya's wolf is named Nymeria. And of course, Sansa's wolf is Lady. And there's something about the way that people name animals that reveal just a little bit about their characters.
Yeah.
Right. We are introduced to Sir Roderick Castle's magnificent white cheek whiskers. Oh, also, we learned that Arya is good with numbers.
Yeah.
I don't know if I remembered that. In other words, she's not good at Sansa at pretty much anything that she's supposed to be good at.
Yeah.
But she's a better horseman, and she's better at keeping numbers. Like,
which, of course, is another nice kind of prefiguring of the counting of the listing of names.
Okay, yeah, tell me more about that.
Well, just in the way in which that becomes such a mantra for her, the counting of names.
Oh, yes.
As we go on forwards, you know, because it's numbers are important to her, keeping lists are important to her.
Yeah, and lists become crucial for her identity,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, very much.
But that's, I was also thinking of that because specifically, I think traditionally numbers have been a masculine chore, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Yeah, very much. I think that's something else that's pointing out the differences between the two.
And now Steve and I break from form to actually cover an episode for a full 12 minutes. Steve, your favorite toe-headed blonde is now on the Iron Throne.
Yeah, yeah.
So we get a lot more Joffrey.
Yeah, a lot more Joffrey.
And we have the introduction to Tywin Lannister, a very arresting opening scene.
Yeah.
What do you think about that guy?
I think he knows his way around a stag.
He does?
It was just so matter of fact, right? I mean, whenever I'm lecturing one of my kids, you know, I can't even really do the dishes at the same time.
No, but think about the impact it would have if you were skinning a deer.
Yeah, I mean, it was the
I mean, medical... anything you say is not going to have that sort of impact.
Right. It's always going to be, you know, any story that you tell later, right? Like my father used to tell me when he was tearing the skin off of a deer.
You could be saying, did you take my phone charger? And all of a sudden, it just has this import.
Right. No, that's true. I guess that goes along with it. But again, I mean, he seemed so like, so precise about it. I mean, for me, you know, because I don't have a lot of stag skinning opportunities. Either no. as a skinner or as just a casual observer.
You're not into taxidermy, for instance?
No, not particularly. Like, I don't even really like to cut my own nails. I get squeamish. So, I mean, I couldn't imagine going that far with a stag. But it seemed so mad. Like, it seemed like, here we go again. Like maybe it's like, I don't know, maybe this is the Lannister equivalent of Cameron from Ferris Bueller's dad, who just loves that Ferrari, right? He just loves skinning stags. It's like, why can't you just give me your full attention? Mm-hmm. Who do you love? You love a stag.
Yeah, I love it. I absolutely love that analogy because Jamie is a little bit Ferris Bueller, just a tiny bit Ferris Bueller here. A lot of entitlement with Jamie, and but clearly a disappointment. Okay, I'm going to throw an idea at you. I think we have a theme in this episode. I want to run it past you. And the theme is contingency plans. So Drogo clearly didn't plan to cross the narrow sea.
Right.
And he ends up deciding to do that. Ned didn't plan to play the Game of Thrones. Jon did not plan to be a steward. Sam didn't plan to forsake his gods and embrace the old gods. And Jorah didn't plan to fall in love. And I think that in all of these characters, we're seeing their character develop with an unexpected turn in their expectations. What do you think?
Yeah, this is sort of your best laid plans notion.
That opening scene, Tywin asks Jamie, why did you let Ned live? Like, why is he still alive? And Jamie was like, yeah, something unexpected happened. I couldn't have killed him cleanly. So even Jamie's dealing with a situation where he had planned it to go one way and it ended up going sideways on him.
So taking your theme and adding another nuance to it, Ned is an interesting one in this because we talked about his sort of his principled stand and how sometimes that seems to get in the way, right? And mm-hmm. And even within his principle, we see the first glimpse of him kind of breaking the rules, right?
Because he writes down rightful heir instead of my son Joffrey or whatever.
Exactly. That is an app. Here he is taking advantage of his trusted position. Mm-hmm. And rather than getting into it at the end of Robert's life here, knowing that who knows where this is going to go, mm-hmm. He's got an opportunity. And he sees so it's a greater good opportunity, but it is different than what his principled stance would have let. Like now his principles are now basically put to the test, right? I mean, he's run out of time.
That, and he's also willing to connive with Littlefinger to make sure that the right people with the right weapons get paid.
Right.
And Littlefinger calls him out on it.
Right. And so, and then again, that's the whole Ned thing, right? I mean, that is, he has a plan and he starts off with, I'm confronting the queen. I'm going to expose your mm-hmm. situation. But as you know, I'm a good dude. So
yeah, his plan is to like reveal the truth. But in order to do that, he's got to do a couple things that are somewhat underhanded, it seems to me.
Yeah. So we've left off with, here is Ned. He's got his guys, and then he's got the official seal from Robert, and it didn't mean a thing. It's a complete upending of orders. And this to me is the big one, right? I mean, this is Ned's whole thing is sort of playing his role. He's not overstepping too much. He's trying to be the best, you know, hand he could be.
Well, everyone's aspirations were kind of laid bare this episode. Ned reveals to Cersei that he plans to reveal her dirty secret. And Renly reveals his plan to actually usurp the throne. And then Cersei makes a play to put her son on the throne. And finally, at the very end of the episode, we find out why Ned shouldn't have trusted Littlefinger for one moment.
Right. So, and he tells him, basically, just as I told you.
He's a little bit like Sergio Romo when he was throwing that no-dot slider. He's like, he's telling you what's coming. Like, there's everyone knows what's coming. You know the pitch he's going to throw. And Littlefinger's like, okay, guess what? I'm pretty underhanded. I want to rule everything. And you probably shouldn't trust me. And then, like, 20 minutes later.
Well, and, you know, and that's it, right? And there's other motivations that are revealed in the brothel scene. This is more than just political. There's a dash of personal in here, too.
All right. Well, let's talk about this guy. So I think he's a really interesting character for a number of reasons. I'm trying to like this actor. This actor is just not doing it for me.
Is it the perma smug?
It's either that or it's the way he's trying to, I don't know. Maybe it's the accent. I don't know what it is. There's just something about, there's just something about his affect that takes me out of the story. Just thinking about, maybe it's because I saw him in The Wire or something.
He feels like he's in between two portrayals.
Does he have to be raspy? Maybe that's it. Like he's on like a phone sex call or something, like, all of the time.
You think the directors are constantly like because, you know, you switch directors from show to show. Like, maybe there's just this disconnect. We're like, nah, I want more rasp. And then the other guy's like, look, I'm going to do the next one. And, you know, I'm going to want you to lose the rasp. So he has to find some sort of middle ground. Because I feel like if he was raspier, you'd be like, yeah, no, I mean, that's how he goes. And if he wasn't raspy at all, you'd be like, oh, I would expect him to be more raspy. I really appreciate this choice of this lukewarm rasp.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sort of nitpicking. You know, for the most part, I think the acting's great. The writing's great. The plots are really intriguing. From time to time, with a cast as big as this, you're going to have one person that just doesn't do it for you. Anyway. Have you ever ridden a horse?
I think I've gone on a pony ride at a park once.
Did anyone tell you could pick any horse you want?
No, it was whatever one was next.
Hmm. So you really can't relate to Jorah being told that he can have any horse of the herd.
Right. Yeah, that doesn't... I'm trying to think of a scenario where I've even gotten to pick anything outside of being on Amazon.
You once gave me a Toyota Corolla with purple flames on the hood.
That is correct.
That was quite a gift. That was kind of equivalent to Drogo giving Jorah his best horse. You gave me a car with purple flames on the hood.
Yeah, that was our best Corolla.
I absolutely appreciate that. And I feel like the ponytail you were wearing as you gave it to me was was equal or better to that of Drogo.
Yeah, I mean, it was a faux ponytail, a phony tail, if you will.
Now, I know how you feel about, just generally about ponytails. I'm curious if you have any feelings about Drogo's ponytail and beard ponytail.
Yeah, I think Drogo is in a unique position to pull that off.
That's good. That's very diplomatic of you.
Yeah, I mean, I find myself, even though not only is he on my television and this particular episode is many years old, I'm still somewhat nervous that he could do something to me if I were to insult him in any way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, he was Aquaman, so there's that.
Have you seen Aquaman?
I saw the first 20 minutes.
That's about as far as I got.
And I thought, I don't think so.
Yeah, I got to a point where I'm like, the odds of this getting the degree of better it's going to need to get for me to justify the remainder of this viewing. I couldn't calculate it.
No,
it
I was told, like, I was not expecting it to be good because it's Aquaman.
Mm-hmm.
But I heard from a couple people, it's actually not that bad. And I'm into superhero movies,
mm-hmm.
But oh my goodness.
Yeah, it was, it was as bad as I would have thought it would have been, but I had the same thing where people were like, no, you should give it a shot. It's fun. And I'm like, maybe. I mean, like, here's the thing. Like, there are times when I have diarrhea that I enjoy it. Not like to the point where I'm like, oh, this is the preferred thing. It's more like, huh, I expected this to be way worse. And and I would say that that's probably how I would maybe walk out of that. Like if I had already paid to go to the theater, for example, and I decided to sit through it and go, oh, okay, well, there were moments of that when it finally was over with. I'm like, oh, it's so bad.
Yeah, well, so a general feeling about the season one at this point.
It's continuing to be effective in its ability to get me in. I mean, that's a lot. I mean, I'm impressed with how many, I'm trying to think of like other series where there's this many subplots that I at least have watched and then still been able to, for the most part, follow.
I haven't charted it out, but it seems like there's probably 20 characters, and I feel like I care about 15 of them.
Yeah, I would agree.
Now I'm going to lay this on you, all right? I've been waiting to lay this on you. But I think that this first season may be among the best first seasons of television of any show ever.
Gotcha.
And you know, there, you put it up against, I don't know, Breaking Bad or whatever. And this is, you know, this is my jam. You got me in my wheelhouse here, so I'm not going to be completely unbiased, but that's my sense of it. And of course, I wouldn't have wanted to build you up for it because there are a lot of ponytails.
Mm-hmm.
But, you've got my overall review.
Gotcha.
Of the series.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive. I mean, it was, it's impressive how, again, how complicated it should be and how I'm able to follow along.
All right. Well, I'm happy. I'm happy with the ground we've covered.
Excellent.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues. But then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question. Who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. First two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV Plus, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Professor of Psychology, Dr. Gregory Webster. Let's start with Arya.
Yeah, so she's almost everyone's, you know, either favorite or maybe top five favorite characters, in part because she's got such an interesting story arc and she's a point of view character. And she's, I think it's interesting to read because she's definitely bucking the stereotype or trope of this maiden girl who's supposed to be, in terms of stereotypes, more like Sansa.
Right.
But she's not. And she, you know, she just kind of wants to do her own thing. She's a little bit frustrated with her gender role, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Just trying to kind of find out who she is. And she's stuck in this social situation where she's not able to fully express who she wants to be, right? And we see that, you know, Ned kind of doesn't really have a handle on who she is or what she thinks she wants to be at this point, so...
Here's my question for you about Arya. I think that knowing where she ends up, I get the sense that there's a certain duality. There's almost multiple sides to her, so much so that she has to grasp on to various different identities, varying identities, in order to explore who she is or who she wants to be. So I'm wondering how you read that. What do we do with all of Arya's different names and all of the different things that she's trying on for size?
Yeah, well, I think one of the major themes of this entire series is identity and what that means to be yourself, to project an image onto, you know, other people, to be seen a certain way, to simply change or adapt and change yourself or identity in order to survive in such a frightening world. And Arya, more than probably most characters, has been through a lot. If we follow her trajectory throughout the entire series, she's been forced into a lot of very difficult situations, and her main goal, for the most part, is survival. Mm-hmm. And to survive, she's had to change her identity constantly. And I think she's gotten to the point now where she's had so many identities that mutability in her identity is almost part of her identity in a way. Mm. And in fact, where we leave off with her, she's an actress now, essentially. She's an actress slash assassin. So, you know, and part of an actor is to be able to portray all these different characters. And so her identity is almost this changeling in a way that's just able to mimic all these other different characters. And she's, you know, trying to use it to her advantage to survive and be an act of revenge.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on a series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
And now for this week's Bird's Eye View. For this week's Bird's Eye View, I'd like to talk about the symbolism of the number 7. In Catelyn's first chapter, we are introduced to the concept of a sept, that being a place of worship. We also meet Septa Mordane in Arya's POV chapter. Thus, we have the not-so-subtle suggestion that the number 7 is going to be symbolically important for whatever religion Martin is building at this point. Now, Martin has claimed that the faith of the Seven is loosely based on Roman Catholicism, or at least what he remembers of it from his youth. But Martin has also said that he never creates a one-to-one correspondence. With this in mind, I would like to suggest that the faith of the Seven is based on Roman religion more broadly, underscoring the Roman part of Roman Catholic. And this can be seen in the importance of the number 7. So I'm going to give you four examples of four different systems of worship that came under the umbrella of the Roman Empire, and I'd like to show how each of them may have contributed in some way to the symbolism of 7 as we meet it in Martin's world. First, let's point out that Rome was a city with 7 prominent hills. In fact, some ancient texts will simply refer to Rome as a city with 7 hills. In the ancient world, we might expect to meet a shrine or some monument to a deity on each hill, generally speaking. But here's why I think that's important specifically for these Roman hills. In A World of Ice and Fire, Martin has pointed to the faith of the 7 as being a product of the Andals. And the Andals believed that their 7 deities were 7 real people that once existed, and their patriarch, Ugor of the Hill, was a real guy. So, in short, we could say that the faith of the 7 is an extension of hill people ideology. So it's just noteworthy, I think, that Rome is the city of 7 hills. But maybe we find the first clue even preceding Roman religion. And we have to remember at this point that Rome borrowed, and when I say borrowed, I mean plagiarized, a lot of Greek religion. Of course, the Greeks borrowed a lot of their ideas from Egypt. But specifically for Greek ideology, we see veneration of the 7 wandering luminaries in the sky. In other words, the sun, the moon, Mars, Mercury, Jupiter, Venus, and Saturn all represented sacred stories. And of course, Rome took over these deities and renamed them, and so there you have it, another incident where the number 7 becomes sacred to Rome. The third possible influence would be from Mithraism. Temples that feature veneration to Mithras will include several altars. And in one temple, we meet 7 altars, each dedicated to a different archetype. Raven, husband, soldier, lion, Persian, meaning Perses, courier of the sun, and the father. So at least 2 of these have analogs with Martin's faith of the 7. Soldier corresponding to warrior, and father corresponding to father. But as we should expect with Martin's world building, there is no one-to-one correlation. So we shouldn't expect, in other words, to find the raven in the faith of the 7. Just so happens that there are 7 altars. It's also notable that if you are an adherent to Mithraism, there are 7 stages of enlightenment. And then finally, the 4th element of Roman religion that would probably have had an impact, maybe the most impact on Martin's world, is Roman Catholicism, in which we find the doctrine of the Trinity featured strongly. Martin has, of course, expanded from 3 to 7. But we should also know that 7 is a prominent number in the Bible, the sacred text of Roman Catholicism. And we should remember that included in the 7 faces of God is the maiden, and this may have a direct analog to the Virgin Mary. So there are 4 possible impacts of real-world Roman religion upon the faith of the 7, that being Rome's 7 hills, the seven luminaries borrowed from Greek religion, the seven stages of spirituality by Mithraism, and the archetypes used by both Mithraism and Roman Catholicism. Finally, let's recall that, as per George Costanza, phonetically speaking, seven is a beautiful name for a newborn child. And that's all for this week.
Next time on Electric Boogaloo.
So Tyrion's back with Shaga.
Yeah.
And Tyrion.
Yeah, Shaga, why not?